All right.
So we move to frogs?
If Brian's on the line, why don't we just bring him on in and let's talk about frogs and other critters from the Center of Eco Studies. Really curious about that.
So, good morning, Brian. Are you with us?
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me on. I am here.
You're being very quiet over there. You didn't have an opinion about raptors, and
I know a little bit about birds, not as much as some of my colleagues. So I'm sure they would have more thoughts on it. But you got the frog guy today.
All right, we're glad to have the frog guy, and we want to clear this up right away. I see your last name is spelled K-R-O-N. Is it Brian Cron or Cron?
It is Cron.
Okay.
Yeah.
I win that bet against Henry, but that wasn't a bet. But it's glad to have you. We've had several of your colleagues on with us on various subjects over the years, and we're glad that you could join us today.
Yeah, I'm really, really glad to be on. Thank you both for having me.
So maybe we should start off just a little bit, very short pieces on what's gotten you into frogs. You're heavy at it. You're a post PhD on dealing with frogs.
So I'm a postdoc at Vermont Center for Eco Studies. I really just love herps, which is reptiles and amphibians. I've been really interested in them for like big chunks of my life. I really loved them when I was a kid. They have such a different life history than us, meaning, you know, they're ectothermic, cold-blooded. They oftentimes have like multiple life stages, like tadpoles and when they're aquatic, and then terrestrial when they're adults. And so many people think they're gross and slimy, and they're just not interesting. And that really drew me to them, because I was really curious about, you know, what makes these things tick that everyone thinks are gross and slimy. And they function so in such an interesting way. They're not only survivors, but they thrive in so many environments that other wildlife can't. And so that was really amazing to me. And the more I learned about them, the more I learned about them, the more I realized how much help they need. And then I just kind of had to just follow my heart and get more involved in trying to help out.
Yeah, and let me just, I had a little checklist of things we were going to cover, but let me jump over. What would you say? Do you have a quick note on what the role of frogs and other critters in that category? I've forgotten what you called them. What's their role in our ecosystem? Obviously they are neat and fascinating and. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a swamp along the driveway coming into my house, so I hear spring peepers and I hear bullfrogs, and you know, and I love hearing them. I grew up spending all my summers on a pond that had bullfrogs chorused every night, mm-hmm. and so it's sort of built into my DNA that I like them.
Yeah.
But what role? How are they important to the ecosystem? Do you have any quick one on that?
Yeah, there's a bunch of ways that they're really important. I mean, first of all, the one that people are probably most interested in is they're pretty good bug control. Not as good as birds in some cases, you know, because frogs are pretty much tied to the ground, especially a lot of the species, or the water like we have here. But they are pretty good bug control. Which can be really helpful. If you're really interested in ecosystems as a whole, they're both predators and prey in the food web, and so they can be really important right in the middle. They're prey for a lot of bird species. They're predators of a lot of bugs and even smaller frogs and some like small aquatic crustaceans and things like that. So they can be really important for the ecosystem. But the number one thing I think that people don't necessarily realize is that frogs and amphibians as a whole are what we call indicator species. And so they, because their skin is permeable, they really rely on having good water quality. If there's things in your water that are going to harm them, or if they are, the habitat goes bad, so to speak, you know, whether it's water or soil or there's a lot of development, or it's too hot or too cold, a lot of times amphibians are going to be the first ones to respond to that. And so we can use amphibians, frogs, salamanders, newts, as these great indicators of habitat health, of how well an ecosystem is functioning. And that can actually be apply really well to humans as well. If you have a, you know, a wetland in your backyard and you want to live in, you know, a green ecosystem that you want to help wildlife with, well, you know, having a lot of amphibians there can be really helpful to kind of get a gauge on how well you're doing in that department.
Wow. All right. So canaries in the coal mine and a piece of the great web that works together. I spent a lot of time on the rivers up here in the Burlington area, and I've watched herons standing there and picking off salamanders and small fish, and I never actually visually watched a heron eat a frog, but I'm sure they're good for it.
they certainly are. We have a green heron nesting in the pond at our office, and I was complaining. I work with a lot of bird people, and I just said, oh, that heron's just going to eat all my frogs in the pond, and I'm not going to get to hear the frogs anymore.
Hey, to go back to the indicator part, and you've been studying, like you say, you're into herps. Can you kind of go back over, let's say, the last decade or two and give us an idea of how the population of frogs is doing? Not only, you know, obviously, we're talking about natural predation, but also effects of climate change and development, et cetera. How are we doing with our friends, the frogs?
That's a great question. In general, especially in Vermont, is in better shape than a lot of other areas, because I think there's a really strong green, you know, wildlife lover group in Vermont more than many other states. I did my PhD in Ohio, certainly much stronger than in Ohio. However, I think amphibians as a whole are generally considered to be in decline. Other researchers have found that they are the most imperiled group of vertebrates, so more than mammals or birds or fish, anything like that, because they're so sensitive to the environment. But with that said, some species are doing considerably better than others. You are probably, familiar with bullfrogs, obviously, as you said. Species like bullfrogs are doing perfectly fine because they really respond well to human development. So we put in ponds in our backyards or in golf courses or anything along, or a retention pond. Bullfrogs take advantage of that. Green frogs as well. Some of those larger, we call them true frogs, really take advantage of that. There are other species that we think are in decline. So we think we lost the boreal chorus frog from Vermont. It was last heard in the late 90s, I believe. But we believe that's probably been extirpated, eliminated from Vermont. But some species are doing better than others. Those that are really sensitive to environmental change, or those that are pushed into competition with other species because of that environmental change, seem to be the ones that are struggling. So I think as a whole, Vermont is doing pretty well maintaining what we have. But, you know, the more development we have, the more that's going to be in flux, because these frogs really, and salamanders really depend on these really pristine wet habitats.
So how much of that is due to our drought flood cycle changing, that we get much more extreme weather events? How much of that has to do with actual pollution, and how much of that has to do with habitat loss?
I would say that, personally, I'm a big believer in the effects of habitat loss. I will say I'm not the biggest expert in the effects of pollution on a population size, right? So I do know they a lot of types of pollution can really adversely affect amphibians, salt pollution, heavy metal poisoning, other kinds of chemical runoff can lead to things like malformations in developing frogs, like extra legs and eyes and things. They can lead to higher mortality rates and lower hatching success of frog eggs. And that overall can really lend itself to a decline in population over time, right? If a frog is giving birth to a lot of eggs that are all mostly going to perish because they're in a polluted waterway, that's obviously going to lead to a decline in the population. But I am really a big believer in the effects of habitat change. And so these environments that are going to take away these temporary pools that fill up in the spring, that most frogs and salamanders lay their eggs in because they don't have any fish. So they're temporary, so they can't have fish. That's where they lay their eggs every spring. And the more we develop and take those opportunities away, the more it's just simply going to eliminate little populations of these species. And, I do think that Vermont is a lot better than others other states for that development. But we are also living in a society that, and with a growing population that wants to continue to develop. And so that's a battle that we do need to fight if we're going to protect our wildlife, but especially these amphibians that rely on like a really specific kind of habitat. They can't just go in any forest. They need to go in certain kinds of forests that have certain amount of, pools and needs to be accessible to them and not get run over by cars and things, all those things that come along with development.
Yeah, I live with somebody who knows a lot about vernal pools, and we have explored several in our area here in Tundridge. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to couple this with the definite need for some housing. So the word development, as far as where people need to live, and at least
right.
Both sides of the party seem to think, or both sides of the aisle here in the State House seem to think that, going near a village. Do you know, or are you concerned? Like, let's say someone says, well, I'm going to, build a development or a big house, and there's a known vernal pool on that property. Is there anything in statute or regulations that towns may have where they would protect those, diminishing vernal pools from potential development?
That's a great question. I will say I'm not 100% sure on this. Our science to policy manager, Emily, is probably better versed on this. I know that Fish and Wildlife is trying to improve the space around a vernal pool that can be not developed. I also know that with Act 250, there likely would be a trigger to review for development in the case of wanting to develop on a wetland. But that's not necessarily, it's not necessarily a guarantee to 100% protect those wetlands.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that, like, there does seem to be some things on the books that can kind of help protect that. I also think that in some cases, landowners that, obviously, I'm 100% for affordable housing, but if you want to build a single-family home on a wetland, you're probably going to deal with the consequences of building on a wetland. It's a wetland for a reason, right? And so even if you remove it, it's still going to be probably, you know, in a lowland area that is probably going to have, you know, other water and flood problems, possibly, you know, just kind of speculating. So long story short, I think there are some things on the books. I think to Fish and Wildlife is working on improving it to continue helping that protection, though.
Good to hear.
Yeah. So I built a house up on high ground on shallow to ledge kind of conditions with sandy soil, overly drained. So there was no water near my house site of any kind. A swamp on the driveway on the way in, so water not all that far away, 100 yards or so. Because I wanted to have be able to see a little bit of water, I put in two very small pools. And I really did them because I thought, well, the birds can bathe there, and it'll be nice to see a little splash of water happening. It'll enhance my view. And I really hadn't thought about the frogs, but the frogs, just like you said, took up shop there, and they lay masses of eggs in those every year, and I always have frogs around those two little pools.
Yeah, they're really incredible at finding available water. And I should also say what we were just talking about with the development of homes is it's not the end of the world to lose one wetland if it's in an area that is full of wetlands. And so development, I think, really and housing specifically is a really big issue in Vermont right now. But, you know, I don't want to speculate. I don't want to make it sound like I'm anti all development or housing. When a habitat is well connected with many different wetlands in it, there is an opportunity for those amphibians to go elsewhere and lay their eggs. It's really the biggest ones are those ones that are not connected to other wetlands, and then you take that out and you lose a big chunk of the population.
Mm. Yeah. I wonder if we might get over into what frogs are here and what frogs to look out for. Can you give us a little guided tour of what's here in Vermont?
Absolutely. We believe now we have 20 species of amphibians with 10 frogs and toads and 10 salamanders. And that's after we probably have lost the boreal chorus frog. And so we have two pretty rare species, the Fowler's toad, which you're going to find in those temporary pools in like sandy prairie areas. But they're Vermont endangered, so they're going to be pretty rare. And the boreal chorus frog is still considered Vermont endangered as well. We also have the American toad, which looks a lot like the Fowler's toad, and you can find farther away from water because toads are really good at holding their water a lot better than the more permeable skin frogs. I'm a really big fan of spring peepers and gray tree frogs, and that's probably what you're going to hear a lot of in the spring is spring peepers. It genuinely sounds like a really aggressive peeping. The loudest pools I've ever been to were just dominated by spring peepers, and I've always said it sounds like what blurry looks like because it's so overwhelming. There can be so many of them, but the peepers especially are a really good indicator of habitat quality. And I love gray tree frogs as well. They are probably going to be more active, especially up here in the summer, but they are also going to be found in those temporary vernal pools and in around like wetlands and swamps, and they're pretty much, they are tree frogs, so you probably hear them coming from the trees. Those are most of our like smaller frogs. We have six species of what I would call the true frogs. If you think of a frog, they are shaped like one of those frogs with big, powerful legs and kind of a pointed nose. Those are like the bullfrog, your green frog. They are going to be found, and pickerel frog kind of looks the same. Mink frog and the northern leopard frog. They all have the same kind of body type, but you can tell them apart based on their color and size and where you might find them. Most of those are found in permanent bodies of water. So those ones that could have fish in them, and they're perfectly fine with that. The previous ones certainly don't want to be in competition with fish with their eggs. And then the northern leopard frog, you can also find a lot in like wet fields and meadows. And then wood frog is another early season species that is kind of looks very similar. It looks like it has a little robber mask over its face. It's brown, or the frog is brown. The mask is black, and you find them a lot in forests. I think they sound like ducks, personally.
I had a vernal pool on my property that I lived on previous to where I am now, and that I was sure there were ducks in those vernal pools. I kept sneaking up on the vernal pools trying to see the ducks, and they weren't there. It was frogs.
It sure was. Yes, the wood frogs are very sneaky, and that's the interesting thing about frogs is they're very aware of your presence. It really just depends on if they care enough that you're there to keep calling. They're very aware if you walk near their pools. So at a certain number, they kind of don't care anymore, and they just think, well, they're not going to get me if you're a predator. They think I'm not going to be the one. It'll be one of my 100 friends, and so I better keep calling.
We have a small pond on our property in Tunbridge, and I have they picked up the chorus quite a bit in the last week to 10 days. But last year, kind of at dusk when it was getting about as loud as it was going to get, I walked down just a little path. I wasn't really even to the edge of the pond, and boom, it's like someone cut the power. It all just stopped immediately. They definitely knew that some big person was nearby.
Yeah, so... You go ahead, sorry.
So if you want to see those, if you just settle down and sit, how long does it take them to decide that they aren't being threatened anymore if you're fairly close to the pool?
That's a great question. In my experience, a couple minutes, depending on the number of frogs. If there's only one or two frogs, they're probably going to be a lot more careful, and it might be 10, 15 minutes even. They may just be really aware of your presence and not call at all until you leave. If there's even like five or six, I'd say in most cases, if you wait 3 or 4 minutes, and a couple of them will start calling again, even if it's, pretty intermittent instead of, it may not be a full chorus again, but if there's even if you hear a handful of calls coming from different, spots in a pool or a pond, usually if you wait 5 minutes, they will, at least some of them will start calling again.
We put your pictures and frog calls up on our notes page for Greenzine, but there is in those pictures, there is a minuscule frog, a frog probably as small as a shirt button. What is that frog, and are they rare, or are they just so small that we don't notice them?
So that is a juvenile gray tree frog. It looks like it is just metamorphosized. If you look very closely at the back of the frog, it's still absorbing its tail, and you can see part of that. So it looks like it's just metamorphosized. So it's a very small gray tree frog, which are surprisingly not always gray. They can be gray or green or brown or any combination of those. I would say they're they're rare in that you probably only see them for like a week, right? Most of them are going to metamorphosize around the same amount of time, probably later in the summer. But because they're very young, they don't really have a good sense of where to go or who to avoid. So if you're in the right place at the right time, you'll see a bunch of them. But they're probably only walking, you know, out hopping around at night for like a week in like July, probably.
Yeah. All right. So one of the things on my list, which I haven't was going to cover early, but we didn't. Can you explain a little bit about the role of the Vermont Center for Eco Studies and, you know, just how come you're there?
That's a great question. So we are here really to advance conservation of wildlife like amphibians, through research, through monitoring of species, through education, and really through community engagement. We want to work to protect wildlife while involving our community as much as possible. And so we try to use these community science platforms like iNaturalist, where people can submit their own observations. And I actually personally use that data in a lot of my work. But we really want to involve the community as much as possible. I think science can be very can be perceived as very exclusive, but it doesn't have to be. And so that's really one thing that we really try to be on top of, is involving the community as much as possible to do science with us. But ultimately, we're here to protect wildlife and to continue to advance that conservation effort through research and monitoring and however we can help.
So did you are you the people who actually created iNaturalist?
No, we're not. We utilize it. We utilize it for our data. However, we are the one of my coworkers created the Vermont Atlas of Life. So if you join the Vermont Atlas of Life, you feed results directly through iNaturalist, so that we try to collect every single record of every animal and plant species that people are recording in one database.
Wow. Okay.
Hey, would that include an earlier question, but I think goes with this Vermont Atlas of Life, which I've heard of before. Would that include sort of a statewide map of these wetlands and vernal pools?
It absolutely does. That's actually something that I work on. So I'm primarily mapping potential species distributions to mm-hmm. Protect land, to prioritize land that we should protect. And so that includes things like a map of wetlands. One of our colleagues, conservation biologist Steve Fascio, has worked to develop a map of all the vernal pools across the state as well, so that we can identify them for protection and, you know, keep an eye on them for, you know, if there's declining frog species or just protecting them in general.
Wow. Great resource.
All right. Well, I will add that to our notes page so that people who want to have a look at that, it'll be there shortly.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you.
So thank you so much for joining us on Green Gene. You're welcome to stick around. I thought maybe we would get into other things. I don't know, Todd. Do you want to do the piece on? It seems almost like it's a flow through to talk about your piece on trees.
Yeah, maybe the trees. But before that, since our guest mentioned bullfrogs, I do have at least part of a song, because I got a bullfrog. And once again, thanks for joining us today, Brian. And if you want to hang around, but you might have to head out to a vernal pool, we completely understand. Here's David Holt, and I Got a Bullfrog.
two, three. I got a bullfrog.
Okay. Not quite so punchy.
Come on, here we go.
Okay, wait a second.
Get through the laughing part of that, but yeah, they got a bullfrog out there in their backyard, and we'll just bring that down in the mix and bring up Henry. Yeah, I don't know about that the piece that I was talking about before, but I do want to get this word out, and this is you know, we want people to get out in nature, and you can do that at the White River Land Collaborative. They just had a wildflower walk looking at ephemeral wildflowers last Sunday, but they are having a program in a couple of weeks, and Emily Bowles, who is kind of the on-the-premises naturalist there, along with Rudy Rudell, is going to be leading this next walk. So it's happening on Sunday, May 18th from 10 a.m. to noon. Emily Bowles and Rudy Rudell will lead a walk to a vernal pool, and we've just been talking about them, a small temporary body of water that provides vital wildlife. Together, participants will look at amphibian eggs, and we've been out doing that a little bit, including salamanders, and seek out other special inhabitants that live in these important but often unseen ecological communities. So I just wanted to get that local information. Also, Michael Sacca is leading some forest walks this weekend over at the Ashley Town Forest. So just a couple local notes for people to know about. I'll turn it back to you, Henry.
Yeah, well, I'm jumping into a whole new territory if we have any more nature-oriented stuff. Now's the time probably to do it.
Yeah, the one thing I'll hold on to until maybe the end is this Bill McKibben piece, but go ahead.
Okay, so I have just a couple of notes I've posted, things that were... you know, how do we fix the world, what's really going on kind of stuff. And so having just bought a used electric vehicle, I've dealt with charging at home in two places, Burlington and Tunbridge. And in Burlington, you have to get your charger connected according to the electrical code, which looks at your service panel and looks at your things you're running and decides whether your panel's big enough. And if it isn't, it's very expensive. You have to tear out the old panel and put in a new one and maybe upgrade the size of the wiring coming into the house. And those rules are still based on what happens if you turn everything on at the same time. So it's a peak load requirement. And at home in Tunbridge, where we don't have to have electrical inspector involved, I have a demand hot water heater that when you open the faucet, it turns on the electricity and heats the water. And it draws about 35 amps to 20, which is around 4,000 kilowatts. And my transformer on my pole is only rated for 4,000 kilowatts. So it's 4,000 kilowatts continuous, but if I were to run my hot water and then run three or four other things and leave them running all the time, after a certain number of hours, that transformer would overheat and I'd be paying for a new transformer. So even though I have 100 amp service, which is about five times that amount of power, the standard thing is to look at what happens when everything's turned on. And so I posted two recent versions of Vaults, which talks about how to do it, how there are smart systems for making it so that you only are using your big power draws when it's important to you to have them on. So like car charging doesn't have to be done right now, or if it does have to be done right now, you can be sure you are not running a electric clothes dryer or something else that's drawing a lot of power at the same time. And it will do it all for you automatically. And there's two versions of that that technology. And the latest version is for something which the utility company could unplug your meter, put this device in at the meter area, and then plug your meter back in, basically have it be something that sits at the meter. And it would allow for not having multiple loads on it, feathering loads, like deciding which is the most important, which isn't, and making it so that so you're not drawing too much power at one time. And that makes it so you don't have to upgrade your service.
Mm-hmm.
And for the utility company, it allows them, when they have a power emergency and you're stressing their grid, they don't want to build a grid that is good for powering everything at the same instant either. And so by spreading those loads out, they can about double the capacity of their grid, save a whole bunch of money, and also fix the grid very rapidly rather than having to build a bigger grid, a more robust grid, which would take years and years and add to permanent costs of electricity. So that's the future of the grid is good, and technology is helping out. And just to further comment on my own meter, I don't have a smart grid device. I didn't spend any money for it. But I started scratching my head, and I say, well, I know that when I run my demand hot water, I shouldn't be running, charging my car. So I just remembered not to do that. But just in case I did do that, I put them on the same circuit breaker. So if I run both of them, it just trips my circuit breaker instead of blowing my transformer. and it's a very simple way. So I've got two 35-amp devices that I have on one 35-amp circuit breaker. And I just have to remember not to run them both at the same time. And so far, I haven't.
There you go. Well, very clever. I'm glad you scratched your head and came up with an innovative way to not blow your transformer. Hey, let's move north of the border to our friends up there who just had a major election at the end of April. Mark Carney is now the new Prime Minister of Canada. He defeated sort of a Trump-lite character named a long-time popular politician in Canada named Pierre Poilievre. And Bill McKibben has a newsletter that comes out that you can subscribe to. Of course, Bill lives over, when he's not traveling the globe, lives over in Ripton, Vermont, and he really likes to do Nordic skiing. And he gives a little interesting background about the new leader of Canada. And he says here in his newsletter about the election that the citizens of the not 51st state rejected the Trump-lite figure and instead elected Mark Carney. This has been correctly interpreted by all as a reaction to the ham-handed bullying of the canned ham currently resident in the White House. But what Bill wants us to know about Mr. Carney is he thinks that he is a world leader who knows more than any of his peers about climate change. and who knows roughly 20 times as much about climate and energy economics as anyone else in power. Now, he's been part of Wall Street and certainly been part of the World Bank. But Mr. McKibben has been watching Carney for a long time. He was a past governor of the Bank of Canada. He worked for Goldman Sachs. But he also looks at climate change. And he goes on to talk about the atmosphere. In 2014, at a World Bank panel, Carney quite forthrightly pointed out that we would need to leave the vast majority of fossil fuel reserves in the ground if we were at all serious about holding the increase in the temperature of the planet below 2 degrees. This was, on the one hand, clearly obvious to anyone who had looked at the physics, but on the other hand, not something that most leaders were willing to say 11 years ago. Those of us who had recently launched the fossil fuel divestment campaign found it to be a good boost, one of three or four crucial moments that turned this into one of the largest anti-corporate campaigns in history. So I'm going to stop right there. You can read the rest of the piece if you look up Bill McKibben's newsletter. But I'm curious, now that he is the leader of Canada, and we know there are a lot of fossil fuel interests in the western sector of Canada, out in Alberta and in Manitoba, whether he will continue that view or whether, for political reasons, he's going to need to soften his stand against fossil fuels. What do you think, Henry?
I don't know how it's going to go, but I noted that when he met with President Trump, that he kept that interaction very respectful,
cordial,
and President Trump was also respectful of him. I mean, he understood that this new Canadian Prime Minister is really got some clout. He knows his stuff, and I think that maybe made President Trump a little bit cautious about how he interacted.
Yeah, we'll have to see. We've got just under 2 minutes to go. I want to take a moment just to acknowledge our underwriters here on Green Scene each week, and they include, I'll go in reverse, I mentioned the White River Land Collaborative a little bit earlier. They're having that walk next weekend, not this coming weekend, to a vernal pool. Wit and Grit, the First Branch Coffee Company, Solar Fest, Upper Pass Beer Company, Solaflect, Bale, Royal Trail Works, and Daniel Leibowitz. I want to point people to a great front page article in this week's Herald, just came out this morning. A coyote expert, coyote, however you want to say it, visited over there in South Stratford recently, and there's some interesting quotes from people that were there and from the experts. So if you're curious about what's going on with our coyote population, pick up the Herald. All right, back to you, Henry. We're into our last minute here on Green Zine.
Yep. So I just direct you to two more clips, and I put in under category what's really happening. These are two podcasts that I had never listened to before, and they're getting into exactly what was happening within agencies in the U.S. government. And one of the people's comment is, this is really a coup from within that we are seeing. So if you want to understand just how bullheaded the things are that are going on, those are pretty interesting.
Okay, Henry. Hey, look forward to seeing you next week. We're going to leave you with a little bit of coyote from Peter Lafarge here at WFVR-LP, South Royalton, Vermont.